Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
I'm Richard Dolan, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
What I'd like to do before we get to listener questions which cover the USO topic, I want to sidebar quickly and get your thoughts on some modern, current, up-to-date, state-of-play UFO questions, and then we'll get back to the USO topic and finish off there. A whole lot has happened in the last few months, Richard, that I'd love to get your take on. First off, the task force that has just been set up by Congress, looking into a number of what, let's be fair, the general public will call conspiracy theories. Yes. So UFOs, 9/11, COVID, the Bin Laden death, JFK, Martin Luther King, the Epstein list. As a task force with a six-month window to uncover the greatest secrets in modern history being set up to fail.
They can't do this all in 6 months. It's just not going to be possible. However, I'm not willing to just speculate and saying that they're intentionally setting themselves up to fail. Although it's impossible for me to see how they can succeed in all of these areas. I personally am glad that this is happening. I mean, let's get real. A genuine 9/11 investigative body. We haven't had anything like that even remotely. So I'm glad to see that. COVID origins, I'm glad to see that. We did have, 50 years ago, a JFK investigation by Congress back in 1975. They did a pretty good job, by the way, at that time. They did conclude that there were multiple shooters. This was a congressional investigation back led by Frank Church of Idaho. And that was their conclusion. So I'm hoping that Anna Paulina Luna, who's running this task force, that they will at least be able to refer to some of the findings from then. But they're doing a lot of things here, and I think it's good that we're questioning it. My hope is that they at least get some success, some breakthroughs, so that we want to continue and follow up with more. And that's going to be the real question. Will they do that? In the case of the Church Committee of 1975, they found their conclusions, shut up shop, and then just headed for the hills, and we never heard from them again. Yeah. So I hope that that's not the case here.
So if you're the secret keepers, the gatekeepers, the shadowy cabal, let's stick with UFOs then for now, that have been in charge of this secret for decades, how would you be viewing this task force and what this administration now, going into the Trump administration, of course, could potentially do. Are you worried or panicking, or is this something you've seen many times before and you're just going to bat another ball away?
Yeah, well, this particular Trump administration, as opposed to the first one, is very interesting for many reasons. I mean, we can see, unlike the first time around, things are really being shaken up internationally as well as domestically. It's really quite extraordinary. And there are people who, you know, Trump's very polarizing, people who love him, people who hate him. But I think even those who hate him, I think it would be a mistake to overlook what is definitely, I'll say, in my opinion, a war that is going on with certain established interests within the United States government and the international, let's say, team global. He's really at odds with it. He's at war with it. How far that will go? Well, we can see that when it comes to UFOs or UAP, there may be not much difference. Take, for example, the explanation that the Trump White House gave on the drones.
Yep.
They had the press conference there, and that could have been word for word right out of the Biden White House, what they said there. So for all of the other types of change that they may want to do, it could very well be that when it comes to UFOs or UAP, it's not clear to me that there is going to be any difference. But I don't want to be guided by that first press conference. I'm not willing to say that they're not going to move on this. It's hard to know. There are a number of members of Congress, mostly Republicans, some Democrats, who are really interested in moving this UFO topic forward. And that is one of the mandates of Anna Paulina Luna's group. They're UFOs and USOs, by the way. They mentioned that. So that's interesting to me. And we're at a point now where, so if I were on this team of secrecy, how would I be reacting to this? One thing that I have to assume that they're doing is they're looking at all kinds of spin and narrative control to come out of this, which is something they're very good at and they've been able to do all along. I mean, think about all of the revelations that have come out in the last decade. Quite a lot, you know, from 2017 onward. We know that the Pentagon has had several UFO-related organizations, ATIP, OSAP. There was the failed Kona Blue. There's all of these things. We didn't know about them at the time. We know that the Navy and other branches are encountering these objects and with some pretty extraordinary encounters indeed. We learned about the Nimitz Tic Tac encounter. We learned about many, many things, protocols that are in place and so forth. These are extraordinary developments that if all of them were to have come out more than 10 years ago, you might have thought, I would have thought, oh, well, disclosure is going to happen. They can't let this much information out and not admit it. But guess what? All of this and more have come out, and we are still at this kindergarten level here. We're still debating, are these real? Are these extraterrestrial? Are these anomalous? That to me is an amazing win by them. That's an incredible bit of narrative control that they've done. So I would never underestimate the deep state or the national security state's ability to continue to maintain narrative control over this. They still, you know, the legacy media, increasingly people don't really listen to or care for it anymore. So that weapon is becoming weaker, but they still have it. They still have remarkable control over public narrative. I mean, think about something like the John F. Kennedy assassination, since this is, again, being researched by the Congress. We're at a point now, it's 60 years after 62 years later, or 61 years later, and pretty much everyone in the world knows there was some kind of conspiracy going on there. Who really, honestly believes that Lee Harvey Oswald did that all by himself and that there were no shenanigans involved in his assassination? You know, the killing of Oswald, to say nothing of the killing of so many people connected to JFK and Oswald in the aftermath of that assassination, which is itself an incredible series of murders. We know all of this, and still, 2025, the official word is that there was a lone gunman at Dealey Plaza that day, even though no one really believes it. The point is, the official word is that it was Oswald by himself, and that therefore there's no justice, no public policy to rectify this essentially coup d'etat of the American government in 1963. So if we're not there with JFK, with all of the knowledge that we have, what are we going to be doing with UFOs? So, or UAP, all of this information comes out, but you can imagine the government, the secret keepers that are behind the government, the nexus of private public power that, in my view, certainly has dominant control over this. They are not going to just walk away from the table here. And they will do everything they can, I guarantee this, to fight the any new narratives that are coming along. And they will just play as much defense on this as they can. So it's going to be very difficult. If there is a breakthrough, it will be something that is beyond their control, something that just spills out, that somehow can hit the sweet spot, as it were, and cause an avalanche of truth. Maybe that can happen. But the game plan, I think we can see, it will be what has been the game plan for this past decade. It is to control the public narrative and spin as much as possible.
Yeah, I think the argument online for many was, you know, they can't put the toothpaste back in the tube this time. They can certainly hide the tube from us, and there's plenty of toothpaste left in it, and they can certainly replace the toothpaste tube as well. So I'm in agreement with you there that it's not an easy road by any means. Something that kind of has happened and has been a bit of a waterfall with is the whistleblowers coming forward over the last couple of months, particularly Jake Barber, coming forward in a pretty explosive way, mentioning his Skywatcher organization, which allegedly now in the next couple of days or a week or so is going to release data. And I think they're being quite bullish about the quality of data they're going to release, which appears to be a good thing. What are your thoughts on this kind of new age of the whistleblower we appear to be in? I'm coining that phrase, sorry folks, you've heard me say it a few times. And some of the allegations around psionics and summoning craft.
I'm absolutely fascinated by this. I was riveted by the Jake Barber interview that Ross Coulthard did. I was absolutely fascinated. I know people, there's some haters out there really criticizing it, saying there was nothing new, nothing provable. News Nation overly hyped it. To the last of which, yes, News Nation did hype that very much in advance, making it seem like this would be an irrevocable disclosure. And it wasn't. The thing about the Jake Barber revelations, as good as they were, and they are good, they're not at the level where they're going to convince a hardened skeptic. They're just not. Barber didn't really give unequivocal proof that he transported a UFO. We saw the video of an egg-shaped object, which turns out wasn't apparently from his retrieval. It was some other retrieval. Okay, fine. Barber gave his strong opinion that what he was transporting and encountering was of non-human origin, but couldn't really prove it. That aside, I think his testimony is absolutely welcome. I'm very glad that we know who he is now. It's hard to impugn his integrity, in my opinion, from everything we've learned about him. And this whole concept of psionics, this is quite interesting. So we're talking about essentially people with psychic capabilities being utilized to communicate with the operators of these craft. And in ways, by the way, that many people could argue are not very ethical. I mean, let's just get real. You're using your telepathic capabilities to vector in these craft very much in a CE5 type of system that we've heard from Dr. Stephen Greer for years. Seems to be very much the same type of thing. So to use that to vector them in and then, I guess what, to disable them and capture them? Is that what's happening? The impression that I get at times is that is what they're trying to do. You could really debate the ethics of that. I would like to hear Jake Barber talk a little bit more about this. But the point is, are psionics being used? And I have no reason to doubt this whatsoever. I think that, I mean, I'm married to a remote viewer, and I have studied as a layperson remote viewing for 20 plus years. I'm fascinated by it. I'm friends with Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ, the creators of the remote viewing program. I know them both quite well. I've talked with many remote viewers. I need no persuasion that that is a real thing, that there is this capability, that we innately have psychic type abilities, and some are very good at it. So why wouldn't you want to use certain individuals for purposes having to do with these extraterrestrials, particularly when you go through the lore, you go through the reports and the testimony, frequently, typically, they will communicate telepathically, so it seems. And so that would be of great use. So I think that's really interesting that he did that. And I'm looking forward to hearing more of what he has to say about this and, you know, whatever results of his organization happen to be.
Yeah, I mentioned when I was speaking to Danny Sheehan that I was on a podcast with some friends of mine. It's completely unrelated to UFOs, very much general pop culture conversation. They wanted to chat UFOs. I sent them the link to the Jake Barber interview. They watched clips of it, and their opinion was they found the notion of the crash retrieval aspect of this interesting. As soon as psionics were mentioned, as soon as his experience were mentioned, they said it was all nonsense and BS. And I think a lot of the public, not all, but would see it the same. I don't think that because of, you know, the nature of what we do, and I can believe these things, but I think a lot of the public still struggle with that. So if you've still got that public perception, and we've got this political progress potentially with these task forces and whatnot, and more whistleblowers coming forward, how do you see 2025 playing out?
Yeah. The problem with this whole phenomenon is that it doesn't behave the way we would like it to behave. We want, and I include myself here. For years, I wanted all my aliens to look like gray aliens with big black eyes. I wanted them all to look the same. I wanted all the craft to be kind of similar. I wanted their behaviors to be similar. Well, it's just not, that's not the case. And then, of course, all the, what we have come to call high strangeness in connection with this. We, you know, implicitly, we don't want that because we want to be able to understand this. We want it to be comprehensible to us. But the reality seems to be that do we human beings actually think that we have figured out the full nature of the fabric of reality? Honestly, do we really think that? You know, Einstein was only a little over a century ago where he comes up with this various theories of relativity. It's not that long. It's not that long that we understand that space and time are a kind of fabric, goes against all common sense. As far as with psychic types of capabilities, look, I think skeptics really need to get over this. The evidence for some kind of genuine psychic capability is very overwhelming, in my view. I think it's very strong. I realize that hardened skeptics won't agree, but there's too much that's there, in my opinion, to dismiss. So that leads to your question, which actually I think I can't remember all of it. I think you asked something like, what would it take? Could you rephrase that? I apologize.
Just how do you see 2025 playing out when you've got a public perception which is still quite stigmatized, but we're seeing potential progress politically and that feeds into the mainstream?
Yeah.
Where does that lead? And I agree, things are very fragmented at the minute and a bit split up.
Well, we're living in an era right now of upheaval geopolitically. You have the Americans and Russians talking as you and I are talking right now in Saudi Arabia. This is a political earthquake. The European leadership is not happy about this, by the way, but it's portending major changes for sure. So there's a lot that is going to suck the oxygen out of the room. It's not just all going to be about UAP or UFOs. To the extent that the public's even going to be paying attention to this is something that I would not take for granted. I would not assume that this is going to be some news headline dominating thing. We did have UAP take the news a bit in 2024. I imagine that will continue. But I don't know that we're going to be seeing disclosure headlines this year. I would be surprised, frankly, if we did. I don't expect that. I do expect some some fits and spurts of moments where it becomes a big thing and then probably will recede. There'll probably be some important testimony that comes out. I expect that we will see more whistleblowers, the new generation, as you call them. I think it's probably appropriate. But I don't know. I don't know that it's going to be any game changer at this time. On the other hand, look, at some point there will be a game changer. And then all of my previous predictions of, well, we're not going to see a breakthrough, will be wrong. And at some point, I do think that all of the machinations, all of the secrecy that's going on to keep this covered, at some point it'll all have failed. I don't think that this is possible to keep this subject under wraps the way it has been for the last 80 plus years, forever. I just don't see that. At some point, it's going to break out. The real question is when and to what extent. You know, we were talking about psionics, and you were pointing out that people are very skeptical of this type of thing. And it's worth it to mention at this point here that when we talk about something like disclosure, we really need to ask, what is going to be disclosed? How much is going to be disclosed? How radical is this hidden world really? Are we, would disclosure mean we're going to acknowledge that, yeah, there are genuine UFOs that seem to be non-human? Or will it involve, yeah, there are genuine UFOs that seem to be non-human, and we've been encountering them for the militaries for years, and we have some of their stuff and their technology and some bodies? Or will it include some of them are alive and we've been communicating with them? Now it's getting a little crazier. Will it include some of them have permanent bases here on Earth and one of them is 2 miles from your house? Is that going to be included? Or will it be included that some of them do abductions? Will it be included that some of them are totally telepathic and can do mind control over you when they want? Because that's been claimed. Will it be included that some of them look like human beings and they're walking among us, which has been a claim? Is that going to be included? This gets crazier and crazier. Will it be that we'll say, yeah, and actually we have our own little breakaway group that has a base on the moon or on the Mars? Like, I don't know if we do, but is it possible? I would say, yes, it's possible. So what we don't really know is how far a genuine disclosure will go or is capable of going. We don't know these things. So as truth comes out in the course of 2025 and 2026, we need to be asking ourselves, like, how far can this go and how much can the public actually take? You think of the general public back in the 1950s, how much could they have taken compared to now? So this is a long path. And I think that we're able to handle more than our grandparents did, but is the full effect of this, maybe the fact that they can manipulate space-time in ways that we don't quite understand, would we really be able to handle this? Would we be able to handle the fact that they have like 3 or 4 times our intellect and they have a hive mind? And there's no way in hell that we can compete with them intellectually or ever can, even if they want to bring us into their galactic federation. Will we ever really be at their level? Like, there's a lot of questions going on here that I don't think that, honestly, anyone in the disclosure community is really asking, to be perfectly candid about it. And I'm friends with everyone there and, you know, I respect them, but I just don't think we've been asking many of these questions.
How long have you got, Richard, left to get into some listener questions?
I'm all yours, man.
Awesome. That's what I like to hear. Well, let's dive into the murky waters then of listener questions. And I got so many through. So thank you to everyone who sent them over. Richard's a popular guest. I'll get to the ones I can. Some of you asked questions that were repeating or others, they were in the body of the interview already. So Algo asks, which cases did Richard not include in the books because they would be too controversial or too weird?
I excluded any case because it was too controversial. There are cases that I included that I discussed without considering them active cases. So I mentioned earlier the Christopher Columbus sighting, which is one such case. I actually did a treatment of it. I talked about it, but it's in another part of the book, not with the cases. But there's some more contemporary ones that I kept apart. So, for example, the Baltic Sea anomaly, which we discovered a little over a decade ago. So that's very interesting, you know, the so-called Millennial Falcon. And I do have a write-up of it. I can't remember. I think I have that write-up in the introduction of this first volume. I could now check. But my conclusion is that it's probably not a USO, even though it's interesting, you know. Another one is the Malibu Formation off the coast of California, where we heard people, Jimmy Church brought this out many years ago, and other people followed up. If you look on Google Earth, there is what does look like under the water, like a flattened surface with these pillars.
Mm.
Looks kind of like a base, potentially, and it is interesting. That one deserves more research, and we really need to get a proper remotely operated vehicle down there and give us some up-close video. But to me, my conclusion, at least provisionally, is that it's probably a natural geological formation. This is what the geologists seem to be saying, and I'm not inclined to argue with them. So I have a discussion of that, but I don't include it as a genuine USO. My attitude about these is, if there's something that's well known, but even if I think it's not a genuine USO, I want to have it in there just for discussion because it's part of our broader discussion on the subject. So I've tried not to eliminate something for that reason. Now, there are cases that I eliminated, many cases, because I just thought they were too threadbare. They very possibly could have been true. But, you know, a lot of the cases that I would find are just, they're so bare bones. There's not much that I can do with them. And I just thought if I have too little to work with, I'm just not going to include it, even though it could be the germ of something that was true. So if there was not enough content to work with, I probably left it out, generally speaking. You know, mostly my criteria was I would include a case if after reviewing it and reading it, I found myself nodding my head thinking, I like this case.
Mm-hmm.
Purely subjective, but I like to think that my judgment on this is good enough. I mean, I've been looking at UFO cases for more than 30 years. So if there is a USO case that I thought, this smells right, I would include it. It was that simple. Very subjective, ultimately, when you get right down to it. It's like, can I do something with this? Can I describe this in an appropriate way? And does it feel, and does it have enough that I would say, yes, this is credible. Decent source or a good testimony that's got detail, you know, that type of thing.
You touch on underwater bases, potentially. Kevin asks, how does Richard assess the likelihood of underwater bases and where would the best candidates be?
Oh, yeah, that's a really hard one. I tried this. I tried to look for any really genuine research or investigation of any sort into undersea bases. What I found was there were a number of researchers over many years who strongly believed in the location of alien bases in a number of places. And I took that all seriously. So there are a few places where I personally think there are underwater bases. I firmly believe this. I'll give a few candidates. One, I would say in or near the Puerto Rico Trench, north of Puerto Rico. There are just an overwhelming number of USO and UFO cases around the island of Puerto Rico. It's ridiculous. I think of Puerto Rico as like the USO capital of the world. It's remarkable. And there's a massive trench north of the island that is incredibly deep, very, very deep. And there have been a number of cases seen at that trench. And I strongly suspect there's something there. It'd be a great place. It would be a great place to have an undersea base. Also, in the U.S., many people talk about Catalina Island. This is off the coast of Los Angeles, a part of what are called the Channel Islands. And indeed, there are many USO cases there. Many, really good ones. I would not be shocked at all if there's a USO base there. But there's a few other locations. One off the coast of South America in the Atlantic, not far from Buenos Aires. I would say that's quite possible. There are a number of researchers who believe that there are bases down. There is a base at least down there. I would never argue against that. Possibly also on the other side of South America, off the coast of Chile, quite possibly. In East Asia, most definitely. I would be surprised if there wasn't a base somewhere in or near the South China Sea. There's quite a bit of activity in that portion of the world in terms of USOs. And but honestly, here's the thing. I could imagine an undersea base almost anywhere.
Mm.
Almost anywhere. There are a couple of crazy encounters that I found up near the Aleutian Island change. I mentioned the Adak Island case from 1945, but there are quite a few from that region. That's a very inhospitable part of the world. And yet we have reports of these objects entering and emerging from the water there. Now, I mean, why wouldn't they have a base there? It's very cold, but potentially you could do it. Also, that region of the ocean is actually very shallow water. You know, we may remember when the ocean levels were just a little bit lower, that region was connected between Asia and North America. It was bearing landmass and it was quite wide. So a lot of that water is only a few hundred feet deep. And conceivably, you could have a base under the ocean floor there. You wouldn't have to go 15,000 feet now. So I think there's a number of places where it's quite feasible that you could have an undersea base. And one other region. Now, I mean, these cases are very heavily centered on U.S.-American reporting. There's a decent number of European reporting, particularly from Italy. I can mention them. But the U.S. has always been very active with reporting this. So it's very likely U.S. biased. So keeping that in mind. But I would still be shocked if there wasn't a USO base somewhere off the northeastern coast of the United States. But there are we're talking the New York, Massachusetts, down maybe even to Virginia area, off that whole ocean shelf could very easily have an undersea base. I could easily imagine that. There's so many cases there.
I had a few folks reach out to ask if you had seen the 4chan post about the whistleblower claims of the giant underwater UFO mothership. There was rumors there was a ship that was mobile, and if it was approached, it would move and disappear for days at a time and then go back. Is that something you'd seen online or knew anything about?
I need to research that because that's quite fascinating and I want to know it. So that I don't know if that's quite recent or not. But I've not heard this. Yeah. So, you know, in the last 3-4 months, I have not done as much active research because I've been trying to put the books together. And that one got past me. But I can tell you this, when the third volume comes out later this year, I do plan to do a last scouring sweep of 2024 and even 2025 cases. And I will include them, even though they won't be part of my statistical breakdown. I still will want to include them. So I'm sure I will look into that and I'll be interested in what that's all about.
Yeah. Melanie says, and I'm going to hopefully pronounce this correctly, can you ask Richard why he didn't include the Utsuro Bune case from 1803? It's called a myth, but has pretty good documentation considering what else was available from Japan.
Yeah, that's... I, you know, maybe I should have included that in the introduction or in the first chapter where I discuss these ancient USOs or claims of. For those people who are not familiar with this, it's based on, we have this very interesting illustration from that period, from the early 19th century of Japan. The idea is, it is a myth. A beautiful princess was found in this kind of egg-shaped craft that came in from the ocean and was somehow opened up, and she appeared. And as I recall, I don't think she was known to say anything about where she was from or what she was. I could be wrong there. It is, I do consider it a myth. I don't consider it a genuine USO event, but I probably should have discussed it at greater length. One reason is that the Japanese and the Chinese both have some pretty good ancient potential USO and definite UFO accounts from their ancient history. Both of those nations have a long history of literacy, so they were able to write their cases down, just like the Europeans did back in, you know, the times of the Middle Ages. So there are some actual very interesting potential Japanese and Chinese cases. And I do discuss some of those early ones, but I think she's right in questioning that, and I probably should have at least had a mention of it. But the reality is I don't consider that a likely USO candidate, so I did not include it.
Fair enough, and thank you, Melanie. Purple Burglar, who again, I'll always say I hate the name because I can't say it with a Scottish accent. Based on your decades of research into UFOs, government secrecy, and the breakaway civilization hypothesis, what do you believe is the single most compelling piece of evidence that humanity is not in control of its own destiny?
Oh, wow. That would take us all afternoon to discuss, because I don't know if I could say there's a single piece of evidence. There's a cumulative argument to say that what we call UAP are real and are physical and are technological. And I, again and again and again, refer people to a very substantial amount of declassified documentation, primarily from the United States military, that attests to this, that describes objects that are not supposed to exist, that are described as disc-shaped, where you have attempted jet interceptions and fighter jets intercepting these and failing to, and with a remarkable amount of description of these types of observations and trackings, electronic observations, and so forth. So that's, I think, a very powerful argument to say there is someone else here and there is secrecy about that. I've been arguing this for 30 years, just about. Now, the fact that we're not in control of our own destiny, this is a very profound question to ask. And I love this question. And I don't know if I want to or am able to answer it fully at this time. I think it's a profound question. The question is, are we in control of our destiny? I mean, we're getting into a philosophical issue here, independent of aliens. Yeah. Do we really, as a species, have an ability to control anything? We talk about artificial intelligence today. There have been people who for 30 years have said we need to stop the development of this because we're going to lose control of it. 30 years, more. And people back then would laugh and say, are you on drugs for thinking this? How can that possibly happen? We have no ability to stop this train. It's a runaway train and we are all on it. We have no ability to control this. You have these people saying, well, we should regulate this and control that. And I just laugh. I think we have such a pretense of thinking that we are actually managing ourselves with any real foresight. I think we're not at all. Then throw in the factor of an advanced intelligence that's here, doing what it wants to do, essentially with impunity. We have no ability to deal with these beings, or limited. So I like this question a lot. And I'll probably want to treat it in one of the introductions or conclusions of volumes 2 and/or 3. So That's about all I can say about it for now.
That's a good compliment for the question. It's a big question, but yeah, you've answered it well as well. Skeptical Believer says, does the fact there are so many USOs and UAP impact your thoughts on what the probable non-human intelligence is or where they're from?
Yeah. I think about this all the time, and I'm constantly trying to refine what I think. This is what I think currently. There are so many of these craft above and below water, around everywhere. So I ask myself frequently, what is their own infrastructure? Like, how many of them are there? How many craft do they have operating here? How many of them physically, what's their population here? I mean, these are hard questions for me to answer, but no one asks them at all. So I'm just, you know, left to my own devices to try to think this through. So my provisional answer is there's enough of them here that it's a substantial infrastructure. So then I have to ask, is that infrastructure here on Earth? Are they building ships here? If so, where? Or do they have an infrastructure far away in some way or another, and they're just able, they figured out a way to get here in large numbers? And I think currently that it's the latter of those. So I tend to think, I don't think they're building their craft here. They could be. It's possible. But I think it strikes me as more likely that they have figured out a way to manipulate space-time sufficiently that these immense distances between the stars are not so immense to them. And that they may have a substantial portion of their societies that are tasked with investigating Earth. It may be that. I mean, think about where we are at in our development. We've gone, I say this a lot, but it's worth repeating. In just two centuries, we've gone from, two centuries is what, 8-9 generations. It's not, think about, mice in a laboratory, 8 generations is not long. So 8 human generations, we go from these wooden ships out at sea with sails, to everything that we have now on the cusp of AI. We've gone to the moon, we've gone out in space, we've studied the subatomic world. I mean, good Lord, we've done a lot in 200 years. That's not much time at all. So I have to think any species that has the ability to monitor us, it's gotta be looking at us very carefully right now, with a lot of interest. So I think I can envision an ET society or group of them that says, all right, we're going to send this committee or this group, and we're going to give some of you permission to visit Earth.
Yep.
Back and forth. Like, there could be a lot of them that are tasked with coming here and going back and forth. If it's easier for them to manipulate space-time, to create the space-time bubble, variations of Alcubierre's equations or whatever, then the distance argument really isn't such a big deal. And you could have a fairly substantial amount of their society able to go back and forth. And I sometimes wonder, maybe that's what we're dealing with. There's a lot of them. And their attitude would be, could be a lot of different attitudes. They could be supportive of us. They could be skeptical of us. They could think, these humans, they are clever, but they're also at a very violent place. Do we want, maybe some of these other aliens are violent. Maybe some of these other aliens are every bit as materialistic and grasping and greedy as we are. It's not impossible. And whether they are or aren't, they might be looking at us thinking, well, these humans could be a real pain in the ass in the near future. They get strong AI. They get quantum computing. Who knows what we'll be able to do in another century? We might be enough that we'll be an annoyance that they have to eventually take notice of. So there could be a lot of things going on where they are trying to engage with us, but they might realize it would be very destabilizing to our world if they were to be out in the open with it, which it would be destabilizing. And we don't know what those ramifications would be, even now. with genuine disclosure. We don't really know. And so they might be thinking, we're not going to be the ones to do it. We'll let them figure this out. So let's not step on the flowers. Let's not cause too much disruption. It's easy for us to go back in time 1,000 years and see why aliens would not announce themselves then. It would be absolutely overwhelming to human societies of any earlier period that it would probably, I mean, honestly, it would probably just destroy them psychologically. I could imagine it would be a really difficult thing for them to wrap their brains around. So you wouldn't do that. I would hope that it would be, if there's any interstellar law that I hope exists, it's that one, some kind of prime directive, where you would not interfere with the development of an intelligent species that is able, you know, that's developing. But so if they were, our ancestors were fragile, what makes us think that we're any less fragile? Maybe a little less, but I could see hyper-intelligent aliens thinking, yeah, you think you're advanced, but maybe not so much, guys. So you figure this out. When you figure this out, we'll make our next decision then.
I could spend all day on those sorts of questions. And if people want an insight into what I think about randomly during the day, things like, and I asked a guest this recently, it might have been Danny Sheehan, I can't remember, around what if there's only about 4 craft? You know, triangles, for example, what if there was 4 on this entire planet at any one time, and people just see them because of the speed they can travel, how they maneuver, they can manipulate space-time. You know, what if the saucers, there was only ever 2 that crashed on this planet? Everything else has been something else, and those saucers were from a different location. You mentioned that manufacturing idea, the whole thing of, okay, so do they build these things in a factory? Are they grown? Are they kind of thought into existence? Are they just there that they aren't even, you know, right, developed? All those kind of weird things that and people sometimes ask, you know, if you got disclosure, would that be the podcast finished because you would know? And I'm like, no, for the love of God, that would be the start of the questions, because there would be so much I would want to know. And I always love to think of, if we got the boring White House lawn disclosure, you know, where it would now be Trump, could you imagine? And Musk, no doubt, beside him with his kid, saying, sure, you know, yeah, here's the aliens in the saucer. We're bringing them out for you. And we say, anyway, guys, the Tic Tacs you've got. And they go, oh, those aren't, we don't know what those are. Yeah, but we've got these Tic Tac things. No, those aren't us. We don't know what those are. We assume that these things would come down and give us all these answers, but perhaps there are many things they don't know.
Indeed. Yeah, I agree with everything you've said there.
Yeah.
We don't know how much the deep state knows about this. We don't know what their knowledge of this is. I'm going to assume, though, that they have more than we plebs here have, but they don't have everything that they want. I'm sure that there are questions that they do not have answered. So that'll be a very interesting little dance that happens if it ever does.
Yeah. So Ricky says, you might have mentioned this in your book, but is there a body of water that most wouldn't expect to have USO activity, but it does?
There were a few that, first of all, these occurred in almost every body of water. Where I didn't get a lot of cases was in most areas of the South Pacific Ocean. But of course, very few people live in the South Pacific Ocean, which I think is probably the biggest reason why. The Indian Ocean, the mass of the Indian Ocean, similar, did not have many, except for the Arabian Sea, which was closer to the shore there, where we do have a few cases. One area that I don't know that I had any predisposition one way or the other, but that had quite a few, was the Strait of Malacca. So the Strait of Malacca, for those who don't know, it's a very narrow, critically important sea lane that's right out by Singapore. And one of the Indonesian islands goes alongside it, and you've got this long, narrow strip of water that these days all Chinese shipping has to go through. If you want to ship to and from China from many parts of the world, you have to go through the Strait of Malacca, and it's not very wide. I have four really interesting cases of bizarre underwater luminous activity that were recorded there. And I don't know what this is, but as far as other bodies of water that I would not have expected, there's one in Asia as well called the Sea of Okhotsk, which is off of Eastern Siberia. God almighty. Like, it's one of these places that's one of the most inhospitable oceans, seas in the world. It's like covered in fog 6 months out of the year. The water is bitter cold in the winter. The seas are rough there. And yet we have quite a few Soviet Navy cases of USOs coming into and out of the Sea of Okhotsk or operating underneath there. I don't know. I think even in the Arctic Ocean, we have a couple of pretty interesting cases that are way, way up, like north of Iceland, north of the North Sea. I haven't really found an area where they just haven't been seen, even not far from the Antarctic coast. There are some cases down by like South Georgia Island, which is getting close to Antarctica. So I don't know. I think they're kind of everywhere.
I'm going to
a couple of good cases by you're in Britain, and I just want to point out there's one of the earliest cases is out of a little river in Scotland from 1767, which I think is an interesting case. Kind of bizarre, but it's interesting. And there's a few others that are from the North Sea, from the English Channel, off the coast of the Bay of Biscay, near off the coast of France there. They're pretty much everywhere.
So these next few questions I'm going to read you together, and you'll see why. So Steve asks, what are the possibilities for citizens or scientists to study USOs, something like a Galileo project for the seas, or will the knowledge be limited to military encounters? And I'll add into that, because I think it bleeds in. Teresa asks, I'm curious, what does Richard think is the best way to investigate USOs, research vessels, mapping, you know, with the waters being so vast?
Yeah, two great questions. They do go together. Well, we're developing better and better types of ROVs, remotely operated vehicles that operate within the water. The capabilities are vastly better than what we had a few generations ago. The best capabilities are certainly with the United States Navy here. But so in terms of what like the U.S. Navy has, we now, you can have autonomous underwater vehicles, AUVs, I think they're called, that no longer have to be tethered to a ship to be able to operate, so they can have a greater and greater range. And I see that with civilian applications happening more and more. I mean, we're now seeing civilian applications in terms of UFOs or UAP are increasing dramatically, where we're seeing more civilian-based projects, where we're trying to detect things like magnetic anomalies in the atmosphere overhead, or we're using artificial intelligence to identify known aerial objects and put a camera up there 24/7 to identify things that are not identifiable. So it's a little tougher with the water. And, you know, keep in mind, there are three fundamental types of water where these objects are seen. Oceans, yes, but also lakes and rivers. So there's freshwater bodies as well. And it's very likely that we might have an easier time with some of the lakes and rivers than certainly with the ocean deeps, where that's a lot more difficult to do. But I could foresee maybe in this decade and moving forward, better use of civilian operated, remotely operated vehicles that have some kind of version of a kind of sonar that might be able to detect things. The problem with that is you would need, and presumably we would have algorithms that could identify a submarine or identify a whale or identify, you know, other types of things that are in the ocean that would not be USOs. So it would take some doing, but I don't think it's impossible. I could imagine a group of interested oceanographers and, you know, maybe ex-Navy people who know the water very well and know the technology to be able to construct a civilian version of a detection station. It could happen.
Final listener question from Russell. Russell says, I see Richard as a historian who has understandably been captivated by the UAP topic. Given that I and many feel we are past the point... A bit of a noise in the background there, sorry. Given that I and many feel we are past the point of no return in the disclosure journey, does Richard ever take the time to indulge in what the history books will document this period like in 100 years' time?
The last part. So have I ever indulged what my books will be like? How they will be seen in 100 years?
The way it's worded, does Richard ever take the time to indulge what the history books in 100 years will document this momentous period? I think there's a word written there somewhere, yeah.
Well, whatever robot historians are at the top of their game in a century, I think they will be seeing the transformation of human civilization and the human species, not just disclosure. I'm a historian, but I love to put my little theories out there. I have all kinds of theories. I love to entertain them. One of them, I call the fourth stage of humanity. I firmly believe this is real. So I think that the human species is going through a foundational transformation of what we are as a civilization, society, psychologically, as a species. And we're moving from hunting and gathering to sedentary agriculture to science and technology of the last couple of hundred years to now something new. And I think it's transforming us, where we are in a digitally ruled world of digital information that dominates, that will very likely be centrally controlled, I'm guessing, and is going to make a lot of changes in our society. One of those changes will be a form of disclosure. So I think historians, human or otherwise, a century from now, are going to see this period of time as one that has initiated a absolutely foundational, dramatic transformation of our species, whether for better or for worse, I can't say, but probably inexorable or inevitable. I do think that that's the case. We can't help ourselves. We're on this path, maybe since we discovered fire or discovered stone tools, started making those, maybe it goes back that early, that we've been on this path where we abstract our thought. We create a world of ideas independent of the reality. That's something, as far as I can tell, humans might be unique on this planet for that. And certainly constructing complex language and complex artificial conceptual structures, that's us. And once we've been on that path, I think we've taken ourselves onto a certain inevitability that is now leading to digital information and a digital transformation of our world. So I think 100 years from now, that's what they're going to be looking back on. And they're going to see that something like disclosure would probably have been inevitable in this context. Because with the digitization of knowledge, the ability to share knowledge, I mean, look at this conversation you and I are having. We have an entire Atlantic Ocean between us, and yet we're doing it. That's because of the digital revolution. So that is allowing us to trade information, share information in a way that was just not conceivable before. And I think that was probably a prerequisite for disclosure. So I think future historians will see all of this is tied together pretty well.
And is it unfair to say or fair to say that in 100 years' time, books like yours, History of USOs, Volume 1, 2, and 3, perhaps there would be even more by that at that point. You know, myself and yourself will be uploaded onto some cloud computer by then. Oh, yeah. People studying this period in time and perhaps studying a period just before disclosure, you know, BD, not AD, yeah, are looking at books like yours as an index, as a research tool to look at how we were understanding a phenomenon that was confusing, a time of upheaval, great change across the planet, and a way of understanding how we were and what we kind of become in that time. Is that what you kind of hope for books like these long term?
You know, that's a great insight, and that's probably the best that I could hope for my books. Any historian ought to recognize that his or her work is never, almost never, let us say, going to be the final word, because we write history from the perspective that we have at the time that we have it, and history is always being revised and tweaked, and it should be, because it comes down to the questions that you ask. That's what creates your history, the questions that you put to the past, and people a century from now will undoubtedly have different and more pertinent questions in the future for them than we have today. We ask the pertinent questions that we have for today. So I think I cannot possibly expect that future centuries from now, they'll be looking at my books and thinking, oh yeah, this is the final word. But hope, I would be very happy if future generations were to look at my books at all. First of all, that would be a shocker. But if they would, to look for, as you say, what were some of the people thinking about this phenomenon at the time? What were their best theories? And yeah, my book would be one that they would look at. They'd look at a bunch of others. And that would be an interesting thing to see. I'd love to be around to do a little H.G. Wells time travel, go into the future and see how all of that works out. That would be a fun thing to know.
I honestly think in the next 5 to 10 years, books like yours and others and people's podcasts and documentaries and articles are going to be used by a wider public who are there now, who aren't quite there yet with the UFO topic, but they're going to have a whole wealth of knowledge to go over to start to understand something that perhaps is introduced to them, that they start to learn about in schools academically, that science begins to study far more rigorously, and that the mainstream media pick up as the biggest story of all time. So I think there's a good chance of that as well.
What I want from this book that I've just published, and the two other volumes that will come out this year, I want it to be easy to digest, which I think it is overall. I think it's one of those books where you don't have to read it cover to cover. You can actually skim and just dive into specific cases if you want. But I also did write it to provide the best foundation that I can into a way to understand this phenomenon, to give my best interpretation at this time of what this phenomenon might mean, not just from our point of view, but potentially from the point of view of these other beings. I haven't really ever before written from a hypothetical point of view of an alien, but I did at many points in this book, particularly in some of the introductory chapters. There's the introduction, and then there's each chapter has its own introduction where I try to provide context. And in that, I'm trying to frame this issue in a way that's easy to read, hopefully easy to understand and digest, because I'm thinking, yes, that the audience for this subject may expand in the coming years. And if there's people coming to this subject and they come across my book, I want it to be helpful. I want it to be something that people who know nothing about the subject can open up and read and say, oh, this was enlightening. This was helpful. That's what I want.
And I think it achieves that, I'll say as much. Richard, how can people get a hold of the book? What is the best way? And there are multiple different versions of it, if you want to mention that as well.
Yeah. Well, it sells off of the Amazon platform, which is available in, you know, many, many, most countries, I guess. It's the easiest way for me to get distribution of it. I can, in theory, get it in, I may get it into other platforms as well. I have that ability. I could do that, and I may do that. Currently, it exists in three formats. The hardcover, which is the most expensive cover version. Paperback, which I just got here in the mail. And ebook. It will be available, I think, within 1 month from this conversation in audiobook form as well. I have someone I have a very excellent professional audiobook reader working on this now. He's excited about the project. He wants to do this, and he's got a great track record, and we like him. So he's working on it, and it should be available soon. I could have waited on the publication of everything to have all four come out at the same time, and I just elected not to do that. But the audiobook will be out soon. So it will be in four platforms, you could say. The hardcover is a bit expensive. It's the most pricey book I've ever published, but I just want people to know I have no control over that. And despite how expensive it is, my own personal royalty is very, very small. Amazon takes about 90% of that. That's the fact. So the printing costs, and then the printing costs were high, and then the distribution, they take, people don't publish, don't realize this, but Amazon takes 60% of all the profits after production cost. So, you know, I priced it as low as I could. The ebook is nice and cheap. That's $10, $9.99 US. Awesome. I try to keep that affordable.
Yeah, I've picked up the hardcover copy. I like hardcovers. And like you say, it is more pricey, but it's a very good quality hard copy. The pictures really pop out. The paper quality is even better as well.
They truly do. I'm during our conversation, I just saw this for the first time, and I'm tripping out a little bit here. I'm very, very pleased with the quality. The illustrations look fantastic, and everything else came out very, very nice. So I have no complaints.
Well, listen, in the week this interview is released, I'll be putting some clips out and selfishly trying to grow some of the social media feeds as much as I'm getting old and find these TikToks and Instagrams hard to use at times. If you can share and comment on any of the clips, I'm going to give away two copies of the book. I will pay for myself. People can pick any version of it. Please don't pick the hardcover, but if you do, that's fine. I'll give away two of those. So look out for any of these clips on social media platforms, folks. And I just want to finish with a thank you and shout out to Tracy, your wife, because she's been extremely helpful to me in getting these interviews put together last time and this time, Richard. And I'm sure you can give her a plug as well, because you do begin the book with a thank you to Tracy and an acknowledgement. And we can end the interview saying thank you to her as well.
Yeah, my wife is more than just my wife. She's my partner in every single thing that I do. She has been intimately engaged in this project with me from the beginning, providing feedback and ideas, many of which I implemented in this book, which made it better. But on the back end, she communicates with almost anyone who ever wants to reach me is usually going to have to go through her, because it's just not possible. I can't do the kind of correspondence that I wish I could. And I'm shocked that she's able to do even what she does. So she is truly my better half. And I thank the heavens that I have her with me.
Well, thank you, Tracy. And Richard, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, Andy, it's been a pleasure. And I look forward to the next time we come back on.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show out on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify. Just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. SI.org.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is
Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short.
Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.